Hello again and welcome back. We're going to be talking about Thomas Jefferson in just a moment. But before we do that, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. This morning, the St. Louis Board of Police Commissioners met a final time before the city takes control of the police department back from the state. Secretary of State Jason Kander has sent a letter to Texas Governor Rick Perry about government-sponsored radio ads, which are trying to poach Missouri businesses. Governor Perry will visit Missouri next week. And the EPA is holding a hearing in Crystal City tonight about coal ash waste in Jefferson County. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. The Missouri History Museum is presenting a very special exhibit on Thomas Jefferson and life at his home in Monticello as he was helping to form the new government. The title of the exhibit is Slavery at Monticello, Paradox of Liberty, and it is a paradox because his actions on slavery were in contrast to his pronouncements on independence and liberty. It goes far beyond his much-discussed relationship with slave Sally Hemings. Who better to talk about it all than the senior curator and vice president for museum programs at Monticello, Susan Stein. Susan joins me in studio. Susan, thank you. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Someone said the other day that it's not Monticello, which I've heard all of my life. It's Monticello.
It's Monticello.
All right. Hey, I'm right for
it. And it's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, too. This whole story really is a paradox, isn't it?
It's troubling to us because we look to Jefferson as the beacon of liberty. He's the person that Abraham Lincoln described as giving hope to all future mankind. Yet during his adult life, he owned many human beings, 607 of them in total.
607. And yet he was not very much different from any of his compatriots, if I may use that word.
That's exactly right, Don. 12 of the first 18 presidents were slaveholders, and slaveholding was common in America in that time. In 1790, 21% of the total population in America was enslaved. There were 293,000 enslaved people in Virginia, 40% of the total population. So it was a pervasive issue and, in fact, I think the unsolved problem of the Revolution.
Is there anything to suggest that Thomas Jefferson was conflicted by this? I mean, other than the fact that, he was obviously anti-slavery in his public pronouncements, and yet he had 600 slaves.
I think by our modern view, he was conflicted because he understood that slavery, as he wrote, was an abomination. He thought it was evil. He thought that it was a blot. But he could not really see a way out of it for himself or for the country.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
His greater goal, I think, was to assure the future of the country that he had helped to found. And America at that point was a noble, significant, global-changing experiment in self-government. And he did not want slavery, the issue of slavery, to cleave the Union.
Which obviously it did, ultimately. And 50, 60 years later, Abraham Lincoln, the man who wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, was still talking about sending the slaves back to Africa.
Yes. It was a different time in Jefferson's time and in Lincoln's time because the common thinking was that emancipated black people could not ever live harmoniously with the people who had enslaved them. And in Jefferson's time, there was a group, in fact, called the American Colonization Society, which sprang forward to liberate American enslaved people and send them back to Africa, to their native lands.
Let's talk about Thomas Jefferson's treatment of slaves. We have horror stories and horrible visions, and we've seen the movies and we've read the books about how slaves were treated, so many of them. Was he a part of the pack that was mistreating in any sense?
Well, that's such a hard question to answer, but I will say that Jefferson was a man of the Enlightenment and also attempted to be an enlightened slave owner. But slavery was an inherently coercive system which held people against their will. At Monticello, he endeavored to hire overseers who would treat his people compassionately. And his own preference was to reward good work with privilege and gratuities. So I think that Monticello was a much less violent place than was the norm, but still was a plantation. And there are few as they be, of harsh treatment there.
I have to take a break, and we'll do that. We'll come back with Susan Stein in just a moment. We'll talk more about Thomas Jefferson and the slaves he held and the period in which he lived. And we'll also talk about the exhibit at the Missouri History Museum, and you'll be there tonight. I'll have more details on that, Susan Stein. Back in just a moment. If you'd like to get into the conversation, we'd be happy to take your calls at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. My guest in studio is a senior curator and vice president for museum programs at Monticello. Of course, that was the home of Thomas Jefferson for so many years. And we're talking about the fact that he held so many slaves during his time at Monticello and at other times as well. Before we go to the phones and take some listener comments, Susan, I have to mention Sally Hemings, because I think when people think of Thomas Jefferson and slavery, that's all they think about. Tell us the capsulized version of that relationship.
Well, the relationship was first published in a Richmond newspaper in 1802, and it was published then that Jefferson had a relationship had a concubine named Sal. And the Hemings family at Monticello numbered about 70 people. Sally was the daughter of the matriarch Betty or Elizabeth Hemings. And historians now believe that she had a relationship with Jefferson for a long time, and that he fathered probably six of her children, born between 1795 and 1808.
I thought that DNA had proved conclusively that he was the father.
Not exactly. There was a DNA study done in 1998, and it showed that a male descendant of Sally Hemings, a descendant of her son Eston, carried a male Jefferson gene. And that Y chromosome can only show that it's a male Jefferson. It cannot positively identify Jefferson as opposed to his uncle or his brother. So, but historians have combined that DNA evidence, scientific evidence, with documentary study and other historical evidence, and have concluded that Jefferson was very probably the father of her children.
I think if we had the opportunity to talk to Abigail Adams about that, she'd probably say, yeah, he was the father, because she was very concerned when Jefferson went off to France and Sally Hemings was going along with him, that there could be trouble ahead.
Well, actually, what happened is that Jefferson was in France, and Sally Hemings accompanied Jefferson's youngest daughter, Mary, to France in 1787. And Abigail wrote about Sally then and described her as being young and actually not so she was only, I think, 14 years old and not really much help to Jefferson's younger daughter.
But Abigail thought that because he was a relatively recent widower, that there could be a match ahead.
I don't think so with Abigail. I don't. That would be new to me, Don, but you might be right, but
well,
it would be new to me.
I read it in some of the literature that accompanied your arrival here, so that is my source for that. We have a call from Tom, who's on a cell phone, so let's get him into the conversation. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you very much, Don. I've got a hypothetical question for your guest that I've often wondered about, and I've never heard it addressed by a scholar, and that is, if Jefferson and the other founding fathers, Washington, for example, had been alive in 1860, how many of them would have sided with the Confederacy, as, for example, Robert E. Lee did?
That's a great question, but I don't. I could only hazard a guess. I would have no idea how Jefferson would have reacted to that. What I would like to think is that Jefferson would have sided with the Union and not with Virginia because he would have wanted the Union to hold. And that was something that resonated with Jefferson and with many, many Americans. It's why I think the war was won, because Lincoln was able to unite people who, Northerners, who didn't think that that slaves had the same rights, but he was able to persuade them to come together, to hold the Union together.
Okay, Tom? I think maybe Tom has left us. Let's bring in Ed calling from St. Louis. Ed, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I haven't really been listening, but I just heard I picked up the phone. I turned on the radio, and I just was wondering if the guests had said anything about what Jefferson wrote in a book about Notes on Virginia, that, because what he says there, if I'm not mistaken, is that Native Americans are just as good as Europeans, but we subsequently, what we did to Native Americans wasn't very nice. I was just wondering, does that come up in your conversation at all?
Yeah, I think that what Jefferson wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia is that he revealed his intrinsic racism in that. And that racism was common enough in that era and persisted, and I cannot say that it has entirely disappeared, but it was a racism of the period, and he certainly held those views.
Can you elaborate on the racism of the period? I know what the word means, and I know what it means today. What did it mean then?
Great question. I think then Jefferson was a person of the Enlightenment, so he was guided by rational thought and deliberate study. And in his observation, he observed that African Americans, enslaved people, were inferior in talent to white people. And he could not determine whether that was because of their enslavement or because of their native attributes.
The generations since, there are, and well, I'm going about this the wrong way. There are many I'm having trouble finding the word. Today, there are many people who are descendants of Thomas Jefferson and presumably Sally Hemings. Can you enlighten us somewhat on that part of it?
Absolutely. Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings likely resulted in the births of four children who survived to adulthood. The eldest, a male, Beverly, was allowed to leave Monticello and presumably passed for white. His younger sister, Harriet, left Monticello in 1822 and passed into white society in Washington, D.C. No descendants of Beverly or Harriet Hemings are known. But there are numerous descendants of his two youngest sons, Madison and Eston Hemings. They left Monticello for Ohio. They were both freed in Jefferson's will. There were five people, all Hemingses, freed in Jefferson's will. And today there are hundreds of descendants, and many of them have been interviewed as part of a Monticello oral history project called Getting Word. And what the collective body of information shows is that these people had strong family bonds, were deeply devoted to their church and to their community, and fought for the equal rights that were promised in the Declaration of Independence. So as a group, each generation had its battles and struggles to achieve equality. And one of the great moments in the show is seeing the concluding gallery with a video of many of the descendants, and also to see a graphic showing that there were 8 descendants of the Hemings family who fought in the Union Army during the Civil War, 4 in white regiments and 4 in black regiments.
You know, I was just thinking, you mentioned the Declaration of Independence, of which she was such a huge part, obviously. But we did a program recently on the Constitutional Convention. The word slavery is not mentioned in the Constitution, and yet it was so prominent in that society.
Yes, and I think that was the compromise of the Constitution was to really push that issue to the side to be resolved later. And Jefferson believed that it was that slavery could not be resolved until its abolition could be agreed upon by everyone. And he didn't see that could be achieved politically in his time. And indeed it was not. It took 87 years to achieve.
When he died, how many slaves might he have had at any one time on Monticello?
Well, at Monticello there were about 130 in any given year, and at the time of his death there were 130 people sold. So he died owing $107,000 in 1826, which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And 130 people were sold on January 15th, 1827, to pay off his debts. A few people escaped the auction block, but not many.
What were they sold for? Is there a price, per
Yeah, person? I think that we do know something about their values. They were valued before the sale. Generally, because they had belonged to Jefferson, they received a premium for that. They were sold for higher than people thought they would.
But we don't know the dollar.
I can't recall it.
Yeah, okay,
if we
okay.
do.
Let's take a quick call from Mary calling from St. Louis. As time begins to get away, Mary, it'll have to be quick, please.
Hi. Fascinating cognitive dissonance going on here. My big question is, I was listening to a story on NPR recently about the Dakota Wars, and there was a document apparently that had been saved in a museum in the territories from Jefferson, basically laying out the scheme, which was to extend credit to Native Americans and in exchange, of course, for guns and goods, et cetera, with the full intention of eventually being able to take their territory. Could you address that?
No, I wish that I could, Mary, but I don't know, and I don't know about it, so I cannot comment on it. I'm sorry.
You live with the ghost of Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. What do you think of the man? Learning all that you've learned and seeing all that you've seen, you like the guy?
Of course. I respect Jefferson as the genius of liberty, a person with incredible energy who devoted himself to securing the future of America. And I also look at Monticello as being the perfect prism to understand the promise of the future and really the problems of that past. And I find it inspirational to look at Jefferson in that way, because you can see that there is great promise for the future built upon a troubled past. And I think it makes it all the more meaningful for us today.
What can folks see at the Missouri History Museum? The exhibit started on August 10th, I believe, will run through the early part of March.
Yes. It runs through March 2nd, and it is a wonderful window into the past. You can see a replica of the desk on which Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and you can read the 607 names of all of the enslaved people that Jefferson owned during his lifetime. That's very powerful. You will see objects that he brought back from France, hundreds of archaeological bits that have been recovered at Monticello, which is the best documented plantation in America, and learn more about the lives of six enslaved families and their descendants?
Well, a lot of people are certainly interested. I understand you have 500,000 people a year visit Monticello to see the kinds of things that you're talking about.
Exactly. And Monticello is a magnificent place to visit, and it is a powerful place to visit because you can see Jefferson's see Monticello's architecture. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the only residence on that list, and also explore Jefferson's ideas and the place in depth.
Susan, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I spoke in error early in the program when I said you were here for an event tonight at the History Museum. My mistake. That was actually last night. I hope it went well for you. Did it?
It did indeed. It was an enthusiastic, great crowd, and there couldn't be better people here who are all interested in Thomas Jefferson.
Okay. We have a link to the museum's website, by the way, if you want to find out more about the exhibit, because there – it is open on staggered days, as I understand it, so folks can check the website.
Yes, and also please come to Monticello.org to learn more about Jefferson and the Monticello Plantation.
Susan Stein, thank you for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll take a look at an international exhibit of poster art at UMSL, an effort in Alton to erect a memorial statue of Miles Davis, and Herding Cats Collective's underwater concert and multimedia experience, a first for St. Louis. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the release of the latest MAP scores and what the result means for area schools, as well as what goes into the accreditation of a school district here. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This program is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, and Spencer Reed. Executive producer is Robert Peterson. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Don Marsh.